I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Robert Mnuchin, Samuel Williston Professor of Law at Harvard and Director of the Harvard Negotiation Research Project, author of the new book, The Jewish-American Paradox. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our young Shinshiniot, Ron Benicote, and Rotem Rapoport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's the last day of the Thanksgiving weekend, which means we are all overfed and quite possibly overfamilied, just in time for the beginning of the true holiday season next Sunday night with the start of Hanukkah. Just when you finish digesting leftover turkey, it's time to start frying latkes. Hanukkah is best known as the Festival of Latkes and Lights, but historically it is much more than that. Hanukkah commemorates events that took place nearly 2,200 years ago when the Hellenistic Syrian king Antiochus IV Epiphanes decided to deify himself, that is, make himself a god. A common practice among successors to Alexander the Great, this meant the king was now to be considered divine, and all proper subjects of the Seleucid Empire were required to worship him. They could keep their original god or gods if they wanted, but everyone now had to bow to statues of King Antiochus IV that he had circulated into every corner of his extensive empire. One of the least important of those corners in the 2nd century BCE was the primitive backwater Judea, what we know today as Israel. Most people there, including the majority of the Jewish population, simply went ahead and bowed down to the statues of the king, whether or not they believed he really was divine. After all, statues were being erected by Syrian Greek soldiers armed with swords, spears, and bows, and in armor. And the Judeans were armed with, well, nothing. The Syrian Greeks went further than that, though. They set up the worship of Antiochus in the temple in Jerusalem, and they forbid Jews from teaching their now heretical belief that there was only one God, and no human image of God could be made or should be worshipped. And the Syrian Greeks outlawed the practices that supported that contrary Jewish belief system, circumcision, Shabbat, the teaching of Torah, and so on. Still, most of the Jews of Judea kept their heads down, bowed to Antiochus's statue, and cooperated with the Greeks. The predominant emotion among the Jews of that day was fear. If no one stood up, no one could be struck down. The central authority must be right. It was in power, no? It had its own religious base in Antiochus and its own ethics. Nearly everybody just went along. But one group of hard-headed, stiff-necked Jews, Judeans, refused to bow to the Syrian Greeks. They followed the traditional belief in the one God and the Jewish practices of Shabbat and teaching Torah. They refused to bow to a human being who thought himself omnipotent and infallible. That group, of course, was the Maccabees, led by Mattathias and his son Judah and his brothers, the Hasmonean family. They stood up to the Syrian Greek soldiers, fought a guerrilla war from the hills of Judea, won some battles, lost others, killed and died, but gradually the rest of the Jews joined their fight for religious freedom. After a hard-fought war, they recaptured the temple in Jerusalem, cleansed it, and reestablished proper worship of the true one God. They established a holiday of religious freedom and dedication, Hanukkah, that we still celebrate today. The lights of Hanukkah are beautiful, but the valiant daring of the Maccabees means much more than that. Without the courage of that small band of brave Jews, there would be no Judaism today, nor any Christianity or Islam, for that matter, nor much of Western civilization, for the belief in the oneness of God was at stake, the freedom to believe and practice as people wished. It was a great and critical victory for freedom of religion in the world. It's a reminder that freedom of religion is only guaranteed by courage and commitment. Reminder we particularly need this year. To play us in this morning, here's a setting from our pre-Hanukkah musical preview coming up December 2nd, starting a week from tonight. It's a powerful version of Hanerot Halalu, composed by Zavel Zilberts. We kindle these lights to remind us of the miracles and wonders our God wrought for us, for our salvation in those days long ago. Zavel Zilbert's Hanerot Halalu for Hanukkah coming up in a week. Just seven more shopping days, plus the eight of Hanukkah itself, of course. During a period when so much of the news has been awful, a great story has come out in the midst of tragedy. After the terrible anti-Semitic murders in Pittsburgh at the Tree of Life Synagogue, many of the funerals for the victims were held at the large Reform congregation nearby, the historic Road of Shalom Temple. When they buried the two brothers, David and Cecil Rosenthal, the entire Pittsburgh Steelers football team showed up to pay respects, including coach Mike Tomlin, quarterback Ben Roethlisberger, and 100 current players and coaches, plus retired legend Franco Harris. An incredible display of unity for a close-knit city and a powerful response to hate. And in some of the churches roundabout, everyone wore yarmulkes in subsequent Sundays, also in solidarity with the Jews of Pittsburgh. An important moment to remember in this season of renewed commitment and dedication. Our guest this morning is Robert Mnookin, and he has something to say about commitment and dedication. A distinguished law professor at Harvard, he decided to write his new book about the American Jewish community and Jewish identity. Find out why when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson.
presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball,
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guests this morning. Robert Mnookin is a Samuel Williston Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, Chair of the Program on Negotiation. He's a leading scholar in the field of conflict resolution, the author of 9 books, including his newest one, which we're most interested in, The Jewish-American Paradox, Embracing Choice in a Changing World. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
It's a pleasure.
So as a prominent legal scholar at a slightly well-known college, what prompted you to move into exploring the whole question of what it means to be Jewish and an American, as you put it, the Jewish-American paradox?
Part of it has to do with becoming a grandfather. I'm now 76, and I began this book 4 years ago when my youngest grandchild, whose name is Cornelius Alcott VI, believe it or not.
I'm sorry, that sounds like more of a Yale name than a Harvard name, if you'll forgive me for saying so.
Well, needless to say, his father is not Jewish and was not raised as someone who was Jewish, but I realized that part of me, although I'm a Midwestern kid who grew up in a reform, rather assimilated family, and in fact, I guess I'm a fourth or fifth generation Reform Jew, really hoped that my grandson was going to grow up thinking of himself as Jewish. And I asked myself, what's this all about? You're not very observant, and although you've always proudly identified yourself as Jewish, it's never been very central to your life. What's going on inside that makes you feel this way? So I wanted to start exploring a variety of issues relating to Jewish identity.
This is an interesting time to be Jewish. You can say that about almost any time historically, but the challenge for American Jews has always been somewhat different than the challenge in other countries, in which there were all kinds of legal restrictions on Jews. America was never like that. Is this particularly difficult to be sort of absorbed into a society? Do you think that's a key?
Well, I think, in fact, what's paradoxical is there has never been in the diaspora a place where Jews have been so well integrated into the larger society and accepted. This is not to say, as we know, that there aren't some anti-Semites in America.
Of course. Unfortunately, we've had, you know, clear evidence of that not very long ago.
Clear evidence. On the other hand, institutionalized discrimination against Jews has disappeared. And in fact, the educational, social, and economic opportunities open to Jews in America, you know, are every bit as great as for anybody. So in that sense, America is very much of a promised land. On the other hand, there's a great deal of anxiety in our community about how effectively we're passing on notions of being Jewish to the younger generation.
We will continue to explore the Jewish-American paradox with Professor Robert Mnookin in just a few moments when we return here on Two Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue based in Northwest Tucson, is celebrating services, classes, and events for the first time this fall and winter. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Congregation Beit Simcha is dedicated to creating a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. As a new progressive congregation in the Northwest region of Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in Northwest Tucson. Shabbat services are held at the Oro Valley Community Center. November 30th, Friday night, Shabbat services will be at 6:30 p.m. A fun musical Tot Kabbalat Shabbat for families with children from infants to first graders precedes that at 5:30 p.m. Religious School, Adult Education Academy courses are at the Educational Center, the temporary one on Oracle Road north of Ina, and festive Shabbat Hanukkah services with latkes to follow are December 7th at 6:30. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services and Adult Education Academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, or go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, the horrible attack in Squirrel Hill at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, 11 Jews murdered in Shul on Shabbos morning, shocked the American Jewish world. It didn't so much shock the Israeli Jewish world, and their response was not, oh my God, this is the worst Jewish attack, anti-Semitic attack in American history, which it was, because in Israel, a terrorist attack that kills 11 people is horrible, but it's certainly by no means sui generis. It's not a unique experience. Their response wasn't as fulsome as we might have expected. Let's talk about that and the Israelis' perception of that.
Well, there's several things going on. First of all, normally when you go to a synagogue in the United States, you don't feel like you're entering an armed camp. You don't have to submit photocopies of your passport in advance. You don't pass through a lot of police checks. You don't pass through a metal detector. It's not like going through security at the airport.
There's not people outside with some machine guns. There's not, you know, an armored car in front like you see sometimes in Italy.
But in Europe in general, not only in Italy, going to a synagogue does feel like going through airport security. You need to do a lot and take a lot of steps. You can't just
let's go
to services.
Pretty much everywhere in Europe.
And so Europeans, unfortunately, are more used to this violence. I mean, first of all, the Holocaust happened in their backyard, but there have been violent attacks against Jews ever since, and probably in increasing numbers as the social disaffection, alienation, whatever, of North Africans in places like France grows. One of the convenient targets for their dissatisfaction and frustration has been Jews. So in one weird and tragic sense, this attack brings American Jewry closer to Jewish communities in the rest of the world, particularly Europe and Latin America, where incidents like this are not unprecedented, sadly, and Israel is used to responding or not responding to violent anti-Semitic incidents around the world. In Israel, the question has been raised repeatedly by journalists, by TV commentators, by political pundits, whether the Jewish community of America can ever forgive the Israelis for their lack of response, for their, let's say, barely adequate response, including the chief rabbi of Israel who refused to call the house of worship in Squirrel Hill a synagogue.
As reported on Too Jewish, and actually to Prime Minister Netanyahu's credit, he immediately remonstrated him and said, this is a synagogue. It was an attack on a synagogue.
But he sent Naftali Bennett, which is probably not the best choice, because he is a guy who chronically makes mistakes and messes up. And it does put into sharp relief the disconnect between American Jewry considered at large, which means all the branches of the American Jewish community, and the Jewish community in Israel, which is pretty much either ultra-Orthodox or nothing. There are some small groups in between those two extremes, but they're hardly recognized or considered legitimate by mainstream Israelis.
There are a lot of modern Orthodox Jews in Israel, and the liberal movements reform, the progressive movements, reform and conservative, have grown a lot, but you're right. The vast majority of Israelis are either Orthodox or Chiloni. You know, they consider themselves secular. And so I think there is a gulf in terms of perception of not just non-Orthodox Judaism, but also they think that Americans are naive about anti-Semitism, and maybe they've been proven right here.
Yeah, sadly.
We'll talk next week. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Ron Benekot and Rotem Rappaport, our Shin Shin Yod, representatives of Israel, representing the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So this is something you taught me that I had no idea. When you're in a high school in Israel, you have a major.
Right, yes.
Well we don't, so tell us how that works. When do you have to choose? Like, how does it all play out?
So it's, for me, it was kind of like a long process because I had trouble deciding what I want to do. But usually ninth grade, you get like a paper with all of the majors your school has to offer. It changes between different schools. And you get to pick one or two or three, also depends on the school. And it's really fun because it's outside of the regular curriculum and you can choose something that interesting for you and that you like. And this time of your school day, it's kind of like a break from all the other things because it's something that you picked.
So you focus on something you like.
Exactly.
All right. So what did you pick?
Mine was computer science. That was mine.
I think that's what everybody in Israel is doing now, last I saw it.
Mine was social sciences and theater.
So very different, right? Yes. Kind of opposite sides of the brain.
Yes, definitely.
So how long is your major period during the day? Is it an hour, 2 hours? How long in the day?
So another thing that is different between Israel and here in high school is that we don't have the same classes each day.
Right. Well, actually, many high schools here vary their schedules, too.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. That's cool.
Not when I was in high school, but now that was, you know, we were riding dinosaurs to get there then, so it's changed a lot since that time.
So we had it maybe three times a week for 2 or 3 hours. Again, it's depending on the subject that you chose.
So 2 or 3 hours each time. So several hours, like 5 or 6 hours a week on your major subject.
It depends on the points you get. The more points you get on it on your finals, the more hours you need to learn, because the bigger the tests, the more
the
points you
get. Right?
Yes. So some classes have 1 or 2 classes a week. 1 or 2 hours a week. Some has 7 or 8 hours a week. It really depends on how many points you get on that subject.
So, like, I can understand computer science. So how do you combine social sciences and theater? Explain how that gets scheduled, Rota.
They have, like, two routes. On our school, they had, you need to choose 2 subjects of 5 points or 1 subject of 10 points. And you have 2 routes, so you can choose one with, like, subjects from each route. So I chose 1 route social sciences and 1 route theater, and it just combines with the curriculum because it's ordered in that way.
Wow, very interesting and very different from what we do here. You have lots of AP classes if you're a good student and you take tests in them to get college credit, but it's really not a major. Interesting. And you seem to have come out of it pretty well, so I'm assuming it's a good plan. Thanks so much. We will talk next week.
Thank you
so much.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The new rabbi is in the midst of a sermon when he suddenly calls over the shamus, the head usher, to come over. The rabbi whispers, "The man in the third row is asleep. Wake him up." And the shamus replies, "You put him to sleep. You wake him up." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So the Israeli government looked like it was about to fall, and then it didn't fall, and all kinds of negotiations. Avigdor Lieberman resigns, takes his faction out. Naftali Bennett threatens to resign, but doesn't leave. He's supposed to get a ministry. He doesn't get the ministry. What's going on?
So yes, to all of the above, all of the above. Yes. So you know, it all started with the military. You know, with a military operation, a secretive one. You know, a unit goes in, does what they need to do, and then unfortunately they are exposed, and they're chased. They get to a roadblock, and then they are. Obviously, there's exchange of fire, and then the head of that mission is killed on the spot, and then his assistant is injured, and then the search and rescue helicopter unit 669, they come in and they evacuate them to Be'er Sheva, to Soroka Hospital. The doctors come and fight over the life, you know, of the assistant, and. We, the Israelis, know that during the exchange, some terrorists were killed. Then we find out that one of them was one of the leaders of the militant section in Hamas, who was in charge of actually the tunnels between Egypt and Gaza in Khan Yunis. And we ordered that the schools will be closed the day after, knowing that there is a high chance of that the Palestinians will retaliate, and they did. And the numbers that I can share with you are between 450 and 500 rockets.
I had 469. I don't know how they know exactly, but lots of rockets.
So they do know. They count them, and obviously we have the Iron Dome that will intercept those that will go to civilians.
So about 100 were intercepted, but still lots
right,
of them
correct.
Hit,
many were not, and right. they were actually aimed at the Iron Dome, trying the rockets to challenge them.
Ah.
You know, so you intercept one, you intercept two. What about the third one, the fourth one, the tenth one? So. And we all know that every single rocket is a violation of human rights. So so they do this, we do that, you know, airstrikes, trying to hurt some real estate assets of the Hamas. And then there's a call for a ceasefire. And then we Israeli citizens learn from the newspapers that Hamas agreed to a ceasefire with Israel. Israeli civilians who live in the south are really upset, saying how come a group of terrorists against IDF, one of the strongest armies in the world, and they agreed for a ceasefire after they attack civilians. Those civilians want the IDF to hit them and hit them hard, so they won't do that again. And then there's 9 hours of deliberation of the government.
Nine hours.
Lots of coffee, lots of cookies. At the end, they say, okay, ceasefire, instead of actually hitting harder. And then Avigdor Lieberman, the Ministry of Defense, resigned because he said we should attack. And then elections are around the corner. And as you said, 61 parliament members, which is a very narrow coalition.
Yeah, 61 out of 120. That is not much majority.
Not a lot, not a lot. And there are major issues that can be discussed and the government can fall.
Fascinating. You know, we think American government is complicated, but coalitions and Israeli government is always complicated, but particularly so now. Well, you know, Wills, it doesn't fall. It's a tenuous government, but still, Bibi Netanyahu remains at the head.
Right.
Like always.
Right.
We'll talk next week. Thanks so much for that extraordinarily precise and cogent analysis.
You're welcome, Rabbi.
Now a word of Torah. This week we read the Torah portion of Vayeshev, which begins the story of Joseph, one of the great narratives in all literature. We'll continue with this fateful tale throughout the rest of the book of Genesis, and the extraordinary plot lines involving Joseph will eventually set up the rest of early biblical Jewish history. But first, Vayeshev starts by illustrating the exploits, good and mostly bad, of one of the truly spectacularly dysfunctional families in all human history, the great patriarch Jacob and his 4 wives and 13 children. If you thought the Borgia family had problems, if you believe Oedipus had a bad home life, if you think the Kennedys were cursed, if you think the Kardashians... Well, never mind about the Kardashians. In any case, none of these epic familial failures have anything on Jacob and his brood. In fact, you can make a case that the Jacob clan has some of the troubles of every one of those. In addition to the vigorous rivalry between the varsity wives, Leah and Rachel, the built-in rivalries between the JV wives, Bilhah and Zilpah, the phenomenal sibling rivalries that take place among all the 12 vigorous, manipulative brothers, all abetted by truly lousy parenting by the patriarch Jacob, there is also plenty of simply bad luck. There are betrayals galore, rape, revenge killing, incest, mass circumcision, mass slaughter, massive deceptions, conspiracy to defraud, and of course, selling a blood relative into slavery in another country. This is not conduct we prefer to see in our own families, of course. Yet, with all the action, of every kind, in Vayeshev, there's also a moment of pure fate, an incident that illustrates something greater than mere human weakness is at work here. Early in this week's Parsha, Joseph is sent by his father to spy on his own brothers. Jacob suspects that the boys, young men by now, have been taking care of Dad's sheep, but probably selling a few on the side to make a few extra shekels. While searching for his brothers, Joseph gets lost, wanders helplessly until we are told he bumps into a stranger who sends him in the right direction to find his brothers. When Joseph finds them, well, his brothers set in motion events that land him in slavery and prison in Egypt, and eventually lead to the whole family going down there, later becoming enslaved, and centuries later getting freed, crossing the Red Sea, getting the Torah. Well, you've heard the rest of the story, and the world has never been the same since all of that happened. But none of it would have happened if Joseph hadn't happened upon a friendly, anonymous stranger who helped him out. That is, all the turbulence, energy, and activity of Jacob's family would not really have mattered if not for a nameless stranger who sets our story onto its true course, one that will eventually end in peoplehood and a great posterity. In order for all of this to happen, some nameless guy just had to point the way. The moral of the story? You never know just what your own small act might do for somebody else, or how or when it might affect history. So in this winter holiday season, why not take a moment? Do something for somebody else, even somebody you don't know. You too might make the world a better place, and help shape a remarkable future. No matter how well adjusted your own family is, at least compared to Jacob's. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, legal scholar and professor Robert Mnuchin, applies his incisive intelligence to the state of the American Jewish community. Find out what he's learned and what he'll share when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Some weird news last week on the hate speech front. In Philadelphia, a neo-Nazi rally euphemistically called We the People took place in Independence Square in front of the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall. It only drew about 30 white nationalists, really white supremacists, and over 200 counter-protesters. Still, the very fact that it happened at all was distressing. There was a great response by Bill Penzi of Penzi's Spices, whose store, located near the Liberty Bell, had to close because of the rally and the security necessary. He encouraged all of his customers to make a donation to the National Museum of American Jewish History, which is located right there. A totally appropriate response. And in an even weirder and also disturbing story, a man at a Baltimore performance of Fiddler on the Roof shouted, "Heil Hitler, Heil Trump," from the balcony. It turned out that he was actually anti-fascist and anti-Trump, and somehow emotionally thought that this response was an act of appropriate protest. The terrified theatergoers did not think so. Not so good. Is America just getting weirder and weirder for Jews? And the Women's March is in danger of splitting over ties to notorious anti-Semite Louis Farrakhan among some of its founders, as well as anti-Semitic tropes being played by others. Women's March co-founder Teresa Shook called on its current organizers to resign, saying they allowed anti-Semitism. In a Facebook post last week, Shook said Bob Bland, Tamika Mallory, Linda Sarsour, and Carmen Perez have steered the movement away from its true course. In opposition to our unity principles, they have allowed anti-Semitism, anti-LBGTQIA sentiment, and hateful racist rhetoric to become a part of the platform. By their refusal to separate themselves from groups that espouse these racist, hateful beliefs. The controversy surrounding the Women's March arose from Tamika Mallory's ties to anti-Semitic Nation of Islam founder Louis Farrakhan. Earlier this year, Mallory was criticized for not speaking out after she went to an event during which Farrakhan said, "The powerful Jews are my enemy," and accused satanic Jews of having a grip on the media. The organizers later said Farrakhan's statements are not aligned with the Women's March unity principles, no kidding, but also defended Mallory against criticism. Farrakhan has a history of making many anti-Semitic and homophobic statements. Last month, he was widely criticized, including by Chelsea Clinton, for a tweet that compared Jews to termites. Following the 2016 presidential election, Shu created the Facebook event that turned into the Women's March on Washington. She became one of several Women's March co-founders, including Bland, Vanessa Rubel, Evie Harmon. Rubel recruited Sarsour, Mallory, and Perez to serve as co-chairs of the movement. Earlier this month, actress Alyssa Milano cited the organizer's stance on Farrakhan as a reason she won't speak at the next Women's March. Sarsour, a very controversial Palestinian-American, has come under fire repeatedly in the past few days and earlier for criticizing American Jewish liberals for supposedly putting support for Israel ahead of their commitment to democracy. Some say her comments echo charges that Jews have divided loyalties. Accusing Jews of dual loyalty is one of the oldest and most pernicious anti-Semitic tropes, the American Jewish Committee wrote to Sarsour. In happier news, SpaceIL, the Israeli lunar space program, whose software manager Asaf Lewin will be here on Too Jewish next Sunday. Don't miss it. SpaceIL announced last week that Canadian billionaire and businessman Sylvan Adams, who brought the Giro d'Italia, a big start cycling race to Israel this year, joined the project to land the first Israeli spacecraft on the moon and gave $5 million to the organization. Adams announced his contribution as part of a special tour of the Israel Aerospace Industries, the IAI's MBT space facility in Yehud, where the spacecraft is being assembled. Adams was celebrating his 60th birthday. He said this contribution to strengthening the Israeli space program and encouraging education for excellence and innovation among the younger generation in Israel is the best gift I could have asked for. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Too Jewish. Our guest this morning, Robert Mnookin, is the Samuel Williston Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, the chair of the program on negotiation at Harvard as well, a scholar in the field of conflict resolution. He's the author of 9 books, most recently The Jewish American Paradox, Embracing Choice in a Changing World. So as a leading legal scholar, you know, if we want to find legal restrictions on Jews in America, we have to look really hard, don't we?
You won't find them.
You know, usually when we pull up books, we end up talking about, like, Ulysses Grant order in the Civil War, which was rescinded. You know, it's not there. It's just not anything that we've had to deal with. There have been biases against Jews historically. It would be silly to pretend otherwise.
There certainly has been discrimination of all sorts. And you're pointing to the one rather conspicuous example of a governmental action that was hugely discriminatory. But, of course, Abraham Lincoln rather promptly revoked Grant's infamous order.
That old line, the exception proves the rule. In this case, it actually does because of the response to it. Nowadays, although we Jews have been focused so much on anti-Semitism with the ADL, and we know that there are some rising pockets of anti-Semitism, there are problems in various places, the real issue in terms of Jewish survival and flourishing has to do with how we define our Judaism. Tell us a little bit about your exploration of it in the new book.
I think that the core question is how well we embrace and accept people who want to express their Judaism in different ways. What is quite extraordinary about the American Jewish community is its remarkable diversity and its vibrancy. On the other hand, there are lots of conflicts within the community, and this issue of, well, who counts as a Jew is one that, of course, is very disputed. I spend a lot of time in the book exploring the matrilineal principle, which has been the traditional principle. I am not a fan of the matrilineal principle. I think it's lineage is not nearly as good as people think it is. It was really a creation of rabbinic Judaism in the second century of the Common Era. It's not found in the Torah or the other parts of the Hebrew Bible. And I think it's completely dysfunctional in terms of contemporary America. I also explore such issues. Well, what are we? To be a Jew, must you practice Judaism? Are we a race of some sort with fixed physical or biological characteristics that can differentiate us? Are we a people? And if we're a people, what does that mean? How does one become part of the people? Anyway, I go through all these issues and end up suggesting that what really should count in contemporary America is public self-identification. I think to be part of the American Jewish community, all that should be necessary is that a person wishes to declare themselves publicly and identify themselves as part of the Jewish people.
So I want to get into that a little bit. Public identification, you know, does that mean on your Facebook page you state that your religion is Jewish, or does that mean that you join a synagogue or participate in a public organization like a federation or Jewish community center? How do you define public identification?
Try to define how someone should express their being Jewish. And the reason I don't, because if you look at our community today, people do it in such a remarkably diverse set of ways. And I don't want to tell anybody how they should be Jewish. I think that's up to individuals to decide for themselves. But what I do wish to require is that you publicly do so. But I'm not prepared to require formal religious conversion, and we can talk about why I reached that conclusion.
Formal religious conversion, and let's talk about that. I think it's an interesting question. By the way, two sort of other points. One of the interesting facts about Jews in America is that we are perhaps the least practicing of all the religious communities by percentages. Another is the fact that we are considered very positively in virtually every survey of Jewish of religious communities. When you talk about formal conversion, if somebody just says, "I'm Jewish," does that make them Jewish for you?
Well, what's complicated about these questions of identity is the answer to your question is that would be good enough for me in terms of acceptance under the big tent, the American Jewish community as a whole. What I really propose in the book, though, is a two-prong standard. One really relates to what's required to be accepted under the big tent, and the second is I want to give individual institutions under the big tent, Orthodox synagogues, Reform synagogues, Jewish federations, Jewish community centers, Jewish film festivals. Institutions should have the freedom to define for themselves what their standards for membership are. And what this means is I do not want to constrict the liberty of, for example, an Orthodox congregation to say, to be a member of our congregation, you either have to prove to us that you were, your mother was a Jew, or you have to go through a formal conversion. Otherwise, we won't count you as a member. I think that's fine for that congregation, but I don't want them defining it for the community as a whole.
There's an interesting trend that we see in some Jewish intellectual circles. I'm not sure that you would fall into that, that says that, well, it doesn't really matter if you do any ritual or religious affirmation of Judaism if you have Jewish values, or we should distinguish Jewish values and ethics from the actual practice of Judaism. Do you think that's a good direction to go?
Well, I think whether it's good or not, I think it is certainly true that, as you mentioned, in fact, I explore this in my book, that the on the whole, American Jews are less traditionally observant, and fewer of them necessarily are believers than is true for our Christian neighbors. I mean, the percentage of synagogue membership is, you know, slightly over a third at any one time. Maybe up to a half of American Jews indicate that they are agnostic or atheists. And, of course, what's striking about Judaism as a religion is we have no catechism of required beliefs. I mean, in the book, I explore the question, well, maybe to be Jewish, what you have to do is demonstrate a commitment in terms of beliefs and practice to Judaism. Judaism does not do that. It's one thing that, in fact, makes us a different kind of religion, or a different kind of religious community, for sure.
In looking at where Judaism is today. In your book, you have many interesting vignettes about people who've taken very different paths to Judaism, converted to Judaism later in life, or becoming active, or being active in various ways, which is, I think, a true kind of mini survey of the way Jews are today. What do you see going forward in this Jewish-American paradoxical community? Do you see Judaism continuing to be vital for people who are sometimes very ambivalent about that identity?
Well, I think that, in fact, today, Americans of Jewish heritage feel more comfortable in proudly declaring their identity than has ever been so. I think, and part of the reason, of course, is that because in America today, the social and economic costs of doing so are so much lower than they've been historically in America, or much less so in other societies I think that I'm not a sage, and I think what's most striking to me is how people over time have expressed their Jewish identity in different ways. And in fact, there's probably more variety today than there's ever been. And I don't know just how it will be done, you know, 30 or 40 or 80 years from now. But I'm really quite confident that the American Jewish community is going to survive. I don't think we're at risk of vanishing. And what the modes of expression are going to be, it's going to be hard to say. I think many American Jews express what they see as their Jewish values through liberal political values of various sorts, a concern for the underdog, a commitment to civil liberties and civil rights. Not all Jews do this, of course, but many do. And I think what's so striking is if you look at the history of American philanthropy, if you look at the history of activism, in terms of liberal causes, the consistently, vastly disproportionate role of American Jews is just stunning. I don't think that's soon going to disappear.
One more question. There's been a bifurcation in the direction that Judaism has taken in America. Nobody would have predicted the sort of revival of Orthodoxy in Chabad and other areas. Sometimes it seems like there's almost two Jewish communities that way. I mean, there's a diversity of Jewish community, but where do you see that going? That's not anything anybody predicted, and yet it does seem to be, although not a large percentage, of certainly a very vital part.
You're quite right. There's been a real resurgence within and vitality in the Orthodox community in America. And, of course, on average, they're having many more children than those of us.
There is a demographic issue here, isn't there?
There is a demographic issue. There is indeed. Moreover, there is an overlap in terms of political attitudes as well. American Jews are overwhelmingly liberal. About 70% voted for Secretary Clinton and supported President Obama. Only a minority, about 30%, voted Republican. And yet, within the Orthodox community, the proportion that voted for Trump and for Republicans is much higher. It's almost the converse.
Yeah, pretty much the opposite. Right.
Pretty much the opposite. Moreover, with respect to attitudes towards Israel, the Orthodox community is much more fervently supportive of Netanyahu and the current Israeli government than the majority of American Jews, who feel considerable discomfort with two sets of Israeli policies, one having to do with the treatment of Palestinians and the occupation, and a second having to do with the official role of the Orthodox rabbinate within Israel that is constantly claiming to define for the Jewish world as a whole what is required to be Jewish.
I want to thank Robert Mnuchin for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His book is called The Jewish American Paradox. It's a really fascinating exploration about what it means to be Jewish today and a little bit about the future of Judaism. Thank you so much. Where can people go to find out more about you and more about the book?
I have a website under my name, and the book is available at Amazon, and I hope at other bookstores too.
Are there any other bookstores today? Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Asaf Lewin, software manager of Space.IL, the Israeli Lunar Project, a homegrown Israeli space program, an amazing development. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our play out this morning is for the coming holiday of Hanukkah, just a week from tonight. It starts. It's Adam Sandler's classic Hanukkah song, version 4. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a wonderful rest of Thanksgiving weekend, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Put on the Hanukkah, here comes Hanukkah, so much Hanukkah to celebrate. Hanukkah is the festival of lights. Instead of one day of presents, we get hey. When you feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree,
Here's the fourth list of people who are Jewish. Just like Jesus, Olaf, Punky Brewster, Scott Rudin, and me. Joseph Gordon-Levitt enjoys eating Kugel. So does Stanley, Jake Gyllenhaal, and the two guys who founded Google.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.